Lecture 14, The Mysteries of the Renaissance.
Welcome to Lecture 14. In Lecture 13, we concluded the discussions of millennial movements. We ended with Jewish messianic movements, and we look in brief detail to two messianic figures. Here we make a complete shift. We move to very different matters. It's essentially the course changes. There are three parts to this class. One, the mysticism and heresy. Mysticism, then heresy and millennial movements. And now we enter into the period of the mysteries. And of course, we conclude with the wish craze. And I want to do this by emphasizing the aspects in which we link high and low culture. Many of the things we are going to be discussing in the next three lectures, or in the next two lectures, really dealt with esoteric doctrines. That is to say, ideas and beliefs which were only open to the very few. And then we move to wish craze, which is essentially a kind of popular beliefs. And one of the purposes of this course is essentially to look at the link between the two. So what I want to do here in this lecture is to talk about the mysteries of the Renaissance, of the Italian Renaissance, of Renaissance Europe, and the new awareness of deep time, and what that awareness of deep time brought to the elite, or the learned elite on top of Renaissance Italy. The context for this, of course, is the Italian Renaissance, is that great movement that begins in the middle of the 14th century and really reaches its high point around the late 15th century or the very early 15th century. Tragically, as the Renaissance reaches its high point and begins to spread through the rest of Europe, Italy as a political entity comes to an end, and I will talk a bit about that later on. The revival of learning in Italy is unique because Italy itself was unique. That is to say that in some very deep sense, Italy was never, quote-unquote, medieval. If you travel to Italy to this very day, if you go not only to the great cities of Italy, but if you go to the smaller towns, which are, in many respects, far more attractive, no matter where you go, you will see the presence of the past all around you. So that you don't go to Italy to look for Gothic cathedrals, except at Milan, the Duomo, because in fact, the Italians were very, very well aware of a different kind of architecture, which harkened back to Rome, which in a sense, they kept always this continuous link with Rome. We call it the Renaissance because the Italians themselves, Italian scholars themselves, call it that. Rinascita, a rebirth. And they saw themselves in a moment of historical consciousness as in a sense being reborn. But what was being reborn was classical culture. And they branded the period between the demise of classical civilization and their own time, Medioevum, the Middle Ages, the time in between. And they look at that period, incorrectly, since I am a medievalist, I will add, as a period of barbarity, a period in which the great civilizations of classical antiquities have, in a sense, been dismissed and sort of deteriorated. Gothic itself is a term invented by Renaissance scholars, and it means Germanic, barbaric, different from that sense of aesthetics which Italians had. This is quite ahistorical for me to say, and I don't want to be quoted on this, but there is also to be said about the climate of Italy and the sense of the quality of light, about the atmosphere and the climate and the topography, because it is a place of extraordinary beauty, and places of extraordinary beauty can also produce things which are also extraordinarily beauty. What I mean to say is that the presence of the past, of the classical past in Italy, but also the context, the geographical and climatic context in which this cultural movement took place, have a great deal to do one with the other. We could actually place ourselves on a moment, select a man, Petrarch, Francesco Petrarca, in a great essay entitled On My Own and Other People's Errors. He tells us about going up Mount Ventoux to look at the view. This is the first literary evidence we have of someone looking at a view and telling us in writing about it. And he carries with him, significantly enough, a copy of Augustine of Hippo's Confessions. And as he is on top of the mountain overlooking the great panoramic view that he sees from there, he opens a book at random. And there, of course, is a passage from Augustine that says, people go to the side of the ocean to see the seas, and they go to the top of the mountains to see the view, and they forget to look into the most wondrous of all things. They forget to look into themselves. And that is, in many respects, characteristic of the Renaissance, that kind of introspection in which Renaissance scholars and writers, Petrarch first of them, begin to look into man, into man. So for Petrarch, it was not what scholars did, a scholastic philosophy at the University of Paris. It was not metaphysics. It was not cosmology. The proper study of man was essentially the humanities, which is why we call this movement humanism, rhetoric. So the great first great master of the Renaissance, the great influence is Cicero. The study of rhetorical devices, ethics, how men ought to behave, so that from that building of the study of the humanities and the turning their backs on Aristotle and metaphysics and cosmology and all the kinds of philosophical preoccupations which were the center of learning at places like Paris or Oxford and so on, Renaissance scholars who are eminently secular turn to a very different kind of learning, which is the learning of humanities, is the learning of what makes man human. It begins with Petrarch and it continues. If one reads the great book by Jacob Burckhardt, which is now close to 150 years old, no, more than, 150 years old or more, published in 1860, and it's the civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, one can see the unbelievable ways in which Burckhardt describes someone like Leon Battista Alberti, so significant, so emblematic of Renaissance, a man who writes poetry, who is interested in architecture, who writes great treatises of architecture, who is a great writer, who plays music, a man, in a sense, who is interested in all those fields of knowledge that have to do with mankind itself, not with philosophical questions, which in a sense separate man from the reality of his world. So in a sense, what we have here is a very different way of conceiving the world, which is unique to Italy in the late 14th and 15th century, which is manifested in the way in which they organized political life in Italy, a world. Because there is no Italy in the 14th and 15th century. What we call Italy is a geographical term divided into warring, often warring, great political units. Florence, Milan, Venice, Naples, the Kingdom of Naples, the Papal States, and a myriad of other political units. Ferrara, Bologna, Mantua, all of them in conflict often with each other. But all of them constructing the state, as it were, or as Burckhardt described it, as the work of art, that is to say, made by the man, by the hands of man, something which is not derived or in a sense descends out from heaven, but which is the world of the people who make it, often tyrants who in a sense legitimize the rule by the patronage of the arts. So politically, we have the secularization of politics in Italy, the end result of which, of course, is Machiavelli's The Prince, the divorcing of political life from the world of Christianity. In art, we have a different kind of art. It's not just that the Italians knew how to paint by using perspective. It is that the selecting of certain, the choices of certain topics, the way in which they represent humanity is very different. That you study anatomy, that you study the way in which man truly are, so that you can represent him or her in ways which are realistic, which are less allegorical than medieval paintings. For medieval artists, it was, in a sense, a travesty to represent a three-dimensional world in a two-dimensional canvas. Renaissance artists take risks in the way in which they represent reality, in which they represent the human form. So in a sense, what we're talking about here is a great and unique transformation that takes place between the middle of the 14th century and the end of the 15th century. This, of course, leads eventually to making Italy the model for all cultural production and cultural development, not only in terms of its art, in which Italian artists go to other courts to paint. Leonardo is a very good example of this. In terms of thought, in terms of ideas, essays, and so on, but also in terms of manners. The high point of this is in the early 16th century, when Baldassare Castiglione writes a courtier, which is, in a sense, a way in which you behave, in which you become what we call today a Renaissance man, which is not only certain kinds of knowledge and certain participation in cultural production, but it is also the manner in which you eat, you dress, you speak. You, in a sense, stand as a model of the true courtier, a man who is courteous, who belong to the court. All that, of course, by the end of the 15th century, begins to spread throughout the rest of Europe. So the Renaissance culture is adopted and transformed in places like the Iberian Peninsula, England, France, even the Netherlands. That is to say, some artistic forms like the sonnet, which have been invented by Petrarch, travel outside. Now, clearly, it's very difficult in a few minutes to describe to you the world of the Renaissance, and that there are other courses in the teaching company that will explain in luxury of detail what the Renaissance was and so on. What I want to do here with this brief introduction is to, in a sense, challenge the idea that the Renaissance is, in the Whiggish way in which historians work, another, should we say, step in the progress of mankind. Whiggish historiography sees history as progress, as progressing always onwards. And therefore, in presenting history to a class or in writing, we always point out to the landmarks. Petrarch, the great man, the great architects, the great monuments. And we see them as part of the progress of the human mind, as that achieving of great points and so on. Nothing could be farther from the truth. This Renaissance, which in a sense created such exquisite works of art, this Renaissance, which led onwards to the secularization of arts and politics and culture itself, is also filled with mysteries. We must dismiss altogether the kind of Whiggish interpretation of history and see that history always has two faces. It's like that great temple in Rome with two doors, Janus, two-face, war and peace. So in a sense, there is the underbelly of the Renaissance, the underbelly of the scientific revolution. And this is what I want to do for the rest of the term, to look at that underbelly. Because two things are very important about the Renaissance. The first one is that, of course, they didn't look forward at all. For people who are so often represented as emblematic of progress, Renaissance scholars and learned men always look backward. It is in fact the realization of time, of the age of history, of that moment of historical consciousness, which is so unique to the Renaissance, when Renaissance scholars can begin to identify themselves with the most recent past, with Rome, that they spend time collecting stones with epigraphic notices that they collect and copy epigraphies, the monuments. Someone like Cola de Rienzi in the 14th century, who goes and collects evidence for writing, Roman writing, that cities begin to, in a sense, become almost obsessed with tracing back the historical ancestries, going back as far as they can, inventing, in many ways, mythologies about their past, always, in a sense, pushing the past as far as they could. Of course, they were aware from reading Roman classics and from reading some Greek classics in translations of the long history of what we call today Western civilization. If you read Herodotus, which of course they knew by this time, you know that Herodotus' histories, when mentioning Egypt and Persia and Chaldea and so on, tells the Greek about the great age of mankind, that before the Greeks and before the Romans, there were other civilizations that were essentially very ancient and very old. It is a story told by Herodotus which resonates in this lecture. It is Solon traveling through the eastern Mediterranean and going to Egypt and telling them about the age of Athens, how old Athens was, and the priest, an Egyptian priest, takes him by the hand and shows him a stela where there are 3,000 years of uninterrupted list of priests who have served in that temple. The Italians, Western men, knew that in the 14th and 15th century. But what they did not know it was that there was essentially an older and deep time which became incredibly important to them. Now, this discovery of deep time has extraordinary importance and consequences for the making of the mysteries, for the creation of a very different culture from the one that we usually associate with the culture of the Renaissance, for the way in which we read that history, we read those texts. By the 15th century, after the first wave of Renaissance scholarship, which concentrated on the precise reading and writing of Latin, so that the medieval Latin, which was a living language, becomes, because of Renaissance scholarship, because of Renaissance philology, a kind of language which is no longer accessible to the majority of the people, a very learned and cultured language, so that they could write precisely as the Romans did. All that essentially is replaced in the 15th century by new concerns, by new interests. One of the things that we notice is that in the 15th century, Italian scholars are no longer limited to Latin. They begin to read Greek. Why? Because Greek works are coming slowly into the West, are essentially being taken out of the Byzantine, of the dying Byzantine Empire, and brought back into the West. We know that they learn Hebrew. We know that they learn Syriac and Chaldean, that they have masters. We know that they learn not only Hebrew, but that well-known scholars such as Pico della Mirandola and others, we have teachers who will teach them not only Hebrew, but will teach them Kabbalah, that they are, in a sense, involved with different kinds of esoteric knowledge, which are very different from reading Cicero and so on, and that all it's that related to the new awareness of time and to the belief, the deeply set belief, that the farthest back you go, the closer you get to the very sources of truth. This is very important because Renaissance men did not believe that greater knowledge lay in the future. They believed that the greater knowledge lay always in the back. And if they could tap, if they could really touch and reach out into that very deep past, into very deep time, at the very beginning of life, then they will receive and acquire a knowledge which was undiluted by centuries and millennia of corruption and deterioration. This is in many respects something borrowed deeply from Greek myth and from Roman beliefs, the idea of a golden age. How do you get back to the very beginnings of time and get the knowledge? In some respects, this is what physicists do today. They want to go back to that very first second of the Big Bang where you create the world. And if we can get that knowledge, then we will know everything that is to be known about the physical world. So in a sense, it is replicated, this interest in deep time, in going back to the very sources of knowledge, is replicated in urban genealogies, in family trees, in which you always try to go back as far as you can in recreating your own life cycle. It is the recent past, which is Rome, which is all about you, all around you, but there is something else. That search for a very different kind of knowledge. Now, Renaissance men, medieval men and medieval men, really had access to esoteric knowledge, which told them of a very different kind of belief, which told them of a very different kind of world. Astrology is mentioned very frequently in the works of Augustine and other Christian fathers of early Christianity. Alchemy had come into the West through the Arabs. It had prospered in places like Spain, like Toledo. It had been translated. But all these works had indeed very little circulation. It was essentially the monopoly of a small elites at the top, which kept these ideas about astrology and alchemy as a kind of mysterious knowledge which they kept for themselves and which did not spread or, in a sense, move down to the popular level. In the 15th century, a very different kind of knowledge comes into the Renaissance first and then into the rest of Europe. I want to tell you this, that this knowledge that I'm going to be discussing here and in the next lecture is far more important to learned man than any other kind of knowledge until the 17th or almost the end of the 17th and early 18th century. That some of the most famous names, people like Boyle, some of the most important scientists, the people who we do not associate with the kind of things that we call today superstition, we are indeed practicing alchemists or practicing astrology. And that, as we shall see, a great deal of the cultural production of the period which we call the Renaissance and the early modern period is really all intertwined with these kinds of knowledge. Something dramatic took place in the middle of the 15th century. The city of Constantinople, which has withstood the onslaught of many powers for more than 1,000 years, fell in 1453 to the great armies of the Sublime Porte, to the Ottoman armies. They batter the walls of the great city with the new perfected artillery, and they move and conquer the whole area, and they establish the rule in their great city, which until then had been, as it were, a heaven for Greek culture in the east. The great shrine of Hagia Sophia was turned into a mosque. Because of this, because of the fall of Constantinople, a good number of Greek scholars fled to the west, and they came to Italy first, and eventually to other parts of Europe, but mostly to Italy and mostly to Florence. And they brought with them manuscripts, books that have lay, as it were, in the great libraries in Byzantium, in Constantinople, waiting for the reading by another eye. Knowledge which was not, in a sense, known in Byzantium at all, which had been neglected and, in a sense, put aside, but which was received in Italy with open arms. Works on astrology, works on magic, works on alchemy, works on the Hermetic tradition. In a sense, these works, when they arrive to a literary elite, to a learned elite, which was already quite well predisposed for this type of knowledge, because in fact they have already been gearing themselves to this idea, because they have been concerned with the idea of deep time. These works that come now in the middle of the 15th century is in many respects a validation, a vindication of the kinds of ideas and thoughts they were having. Think about this. When in the middle of the 15th century, the several works come to Florence. They come to the Platonic Academy, or what will be called later the Platonic Academy. They come into the hands of the Medici ruler of Florence, who gives them to one of his men, to one of his, shall we say it, educators or literary types who lived in his court and who is under his patronage, a doctor, in fact, named Marsilio Ficino. And think about this. They come among the works, the great Corpus Hermeticum, about which I will say a great deal later on, and the Asclepius, two works of Hermeticism. And it also comes one of Plato's greatest dialogue, the Symposium. And the question is which one you're going to translate first, from Greek to Latin. And the decision, of course, is made immediately. The Corpus Hermeticum is far more important than Plato because it is older. No one today in the general public has ever heard of Hermeticism. No one today, or very few people, unless you are in the field, ever read the Corpus Hermeticum, which I will describe to you in the next lecture. And yet, at this precise moment in the middle of the 15th century, it is no question about which one is closest to the truth. And that is, of course, the Asclepius and the Corpus Hermeticum. So in a sense, what I'm going to do in the next lecture is to go in some detail on these four traditions, what I call the mysteries. The first one, of course, is astrology, which is, and I will describe it in greater detail later on, but what I want to introduce to you now, astrology, the idea that there is a link, there is a bridge between the human soul and the stars, between the macrocosm of the universe and the microcosm of humans. Then alchemy, or alchemia, or the ancient chemistry, which dates back to Chaldean and Babylonian ancestries, which is transmitted by the Arabs, who are very adept at alchemy, which enters Europe through the Arabs in the 10th and 11th century, and which becomes widespread among a small circle, elite of learned men, and which seeks more than just a transmutation of metals, which seeks, in many respects, to discover the very meaning and essence of life, the anima mundi, the soul of the world. Then magic, which of course has both elite as well as popular sides to it, although the high magic, the good magic, not to be confused with malefic magic, the magic of the picatrix, the use of amulets and so on, is also a well-known lore among a small elite. And finally, the one to which I will give most of my time in the next lecture, the Hermetic corpus, Hermeticism, a whole mumbo-jumbo of several doctrines which acquired extraordinary influence and extraordinary importance in Europe because it was believed that it was the work of someone who was a contemporary of Moses. So in the next lecture, we are going to look in detail at Hermeticism and in some detail at the other three. Thank you.